So do you want to know what I was most disappointed by when I saw Kim Derrick's leaked
That's Sir emails? Kim.
Sir Kim Derrick, British ambassador, former. Why did he use words like inept and clumsy to describe the president of the administration when there are so many better words like British slang?
Oh, but there's –
Like it's, daft.
It's classic British understatement. They're just clumsy, which is to say they fall flat on their faces all the time.
Well, but hang on. We got to give Kim Derrick credit. Because that Terminator rising from the – it was a freaking great metaphor.
It really is. Like, it really is.
And this I don't know why we'd never thought of it.
This is part of the long-running U.S.-U.K. competition over which foreign service writes better cables. You didn't know about this?
Is that true?
No, it's a thing.
Well, he's definitely ahead, even if he didn't use the word pillock or muppet.
You have to read them in a British accent to get like the full effect of them.
Yeah, exactly. His 2020 slogan will be, I'll be back. Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the special relationship edition. It's such a special relationship.
It is a special relationship.
Well, it's a little candid observation among friends.
We have a special relationship.
We do have a very special relationship.
Because I say all that shit about you guys behind your backs, too.
And we love you for it. It's your job.
Totally. It is your job. If your cables to your family about all of us were leaked, I'd be like, listen, Susan speaks truth to power. This is what we pay her to do.
Wait, we pay her?
Shh. That's in my cable. She only thinks she's being paid. We are here in the New Jungle Studio with my good friends Tamara Kaufman Wittes, Ben Wittes, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Shane.
And it's blissfully not 110 degrees in Washington this week, which feels great. This week on the podcast, the British ambassador to the United States resigns after his candid opinions on President Trump are leaked. Federal prosecutors intensify their investigation of a top Trump fundraiser. And a malicious conspiracy theory about a murdered DNC staffer turns out was planted by Russian intelligence agents. Go figure. So let's start with the big news, I guess, of the week. Sir Kim Derrick announced today, Wednesday, that he would resign as U.S. ambassador, feeling that it had become untenable, his situation, after a number of diptels. Diptels, is that what we call them? Diplomatic tele... cables, not emails, like actual God's honest cables, like things that only a few people should have access to, were leaked to the Daily Mail. And I should note also to a journalist for the Mail who is a known sort of Brexit cheerleader and I think is seen as somebody who is aligned with the hard right and the kind of people who would probably not think that highly of Sir Kim in the first place, or the British Civil Service for that matter, and you know, showed that he was writing back things to London that probably he's heard from hundreds of people in Washington, including from, I'm sure, the president's own senior staff about how chaotic things are inside the White House. There was nothing shocking in the emails, but obviously it created – you know, a big kind of diplomatic riff. And Tammy, maybe just the first place to start on this is, you know, A, why is it a problem to have a diplomat's candid observations out like this? And B, was the reaction from this administration appropriate, or should we have followed some other course? Like, what is the diplomatic thing to do in a delicate, undiplomatic moment, I guess?
Wow. So I think that's actually a more complicated question to answer than it may seem at first, because of course diplomatic representatives need to be able to send candid assessments, even if they're ugly, back to their capitals. Their leaders deserve candid assessments, and they deserve to be able to prepare appropriately for engagements with the U.S. leadership. And so if the U.S. leadership has no policy process, if it's clumsy, if it's confused, if it's internally riven, all these things that Sir Kim described, then Theresa May needs to know that, because she can't engage effectively if she's working on a different set of assumptions. The problem is, once this stuff is revealed in public, two things happen. One is that everyone who was talking to Sir Kim before worries about another leak. And so then they don't speak frankly to him anymore, because they're not convinced he can ensure the security of their information. So he becomes less effective in collecting information about Washington.
It's almost like a reporter's notebook getting dumped or something.
Totally. But then the other thing is that his interlocutors inside the U.S. administration say, my God, he thinks we're inept. And so they can't interact with him in the same way or with the same level of trust or mutuality as before. And so although it's entirely unfair to see a man compelled to resign because the White House cut him out and said they wouldn't talk to him anymore, it's unfair to see that happen to him for doing exactly what his job is to do. It is the case that his effectiveness was compromised by this leak. It was. And even if the White House hadn't chosen to freeze him out, it would have made his job more difficult.
What about the president's blasting him on Twitter and calling him a fool and no one likes you, which, P.S., I mean, the number of people from the president's own staff who have partied into the night with Kim Derrick is not small.
Yeah, I think Sir Kim is one of the beloved members of the diplomatic corps in Washington, and I think he will be much missed. And so I think what Trump did there actually is, as is often the case when he launches on somebody, he just drew more attention to the issue. He made it an issue of national media coverage and not just a Washington story. And so I don't think he did himself any favors. But I think the practical effect of Sir Kim resigning at this point, even though his government was formally standing by him and very carefully apologizing for the leak but not apologizing for what he said – the effect practically is that Theresa May is going to be the one who's able to appoint his successor rather than having him stick around as a kind of lame duck and then let May's successor, who may be Boris Johnson or another, you know, populist Brexiteer, appoint Sir Kim's successor.
But how does that square with sort of reports that the reason he decided to step down, notwithstanding sort of the formal support of the government, was because Boris Johnson had made statements indicating that he wouldn't necessarily support him? And that actually appears to be the thing that was the catalyst for the decision to step down.
Yeah, I saw that reporting too. And it, certainly if I were in that job and I saw that my principal didn't have my back, that might induce me to write a resignation letter. But that's a difference between Boris Johnson's position now and the position he aspires to have. And I do think that difference is relevant.
And it also strikes me that, I mean, Boris Johnson would have found himself in a very tough spot. I was talking to somebody in London today about this actually, that if he had gone ahead and said, no, 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 he can stay, you know, there would have been, you know, people sort of to his right, they would have been saying this is outrageous. You know, you've got this ambassador who, to your point, Tammy, is ineffective. He can't possibly do his job. We have to negotiate a trade deal with the United States. How could you possibly leave him there? At the same time, you know, it kind of blows back on Boris Johnson because now he's seen as somebody who throws senior civil servants under the bus.
And is ready to be bullied by Donald Trump.
And is ready to be bullied by Trump, precisely. So, I mean, with this person I was talking to, I said, look, he is kind of between a rock and a hard place because on the one hand, if he lets him stay, he is compromised and he's going to face criticism internally. On the other hand, by essentially compelling his resignation, he looks like he's being a poodle for Trump.
Yeah. So I want to say there's one person who did everything right here, and it's Kim Darrow.
Oh, he's coming out smelling like a rose. Know, and I think he's probably sitting back having a good chuckle.
Actually, what Boris Johnson could do if he wanted to show that he refuses to be bullied is immediately appoint him to another senior ambassadorship.
Right. You know, look, this is a guy who – an ambassador has three things that they're supposed to do. One is – speak on behalf of their government appropriately. He's done that. None of the things that he's said to have said and pretty clearly did say were anything other than private official communications. Number two, he's supposed to give candid advice to his own government. He did that. And number three, he's supposed to remove himself from any situation in which he is the issue. And now he's become the issue. The president is tweeting bile about him. It is not in his government's interest for him to be the issue. And so he's removed himself from the situation. And I think it is hard to say that he did not do anything but what was appropriate in all of these circumstances. And that said, it's a loss because this is a person who is, you know, contrary to what the president says, extremely well regarded in the United States, extremely.
It has been even before he was the ambassador.
Yeah, well, he was the national security advisor as well. I mean, somebody with very deep experience and is exactly the opposite, as with many things, the truth is exactly the opposite of the president's tweets. He's well-liked, well-respected, and well-known around Washington. And so, you know, it's another example of the everything Trump touches dies principle.
You know, I mean, look, okay. I have to say, I do – while I agree, right, that he'd – this leak had rendered him sort of potentially ineffective and had made him the story and that it might be appropriate to step down, I do think this was a strategic mistake on the part of the Brits, in part because his tenure was coming to an end at the end of the year.
Yeah, he was about to go
home. We were only talking about 6 more months. It would have been easily to quietly accelerate that to, you know, Thanksgiving or something such that, you know, you had deputies in place and were sort of – could quietly make that transition happen a little bit faster. And so – really, you only needed the Brits in this case only needed to sort of deal with the consequences to the relationship for a relatively short period of time. And so the trade-off of appearing to capitulate to Trump's temper tantrums, right, whenever he's openly insulting your ambassadors, it just looks incredibly weak. And two, to stand up and defend this norm of, you know, we need our ambassadors to give full candid advice. If this was an inside leak, which it appears to be, that's totally unacceptable as a matter of domestic politics. If speculations that it was some kind of external hack by the Russians or others are true, that also would be, you know, something that you would want to be very, very clear that that behavior is not going to be rewarded by giving whoever made this public precisely what they would want. And so it seems to me like those are really, really important principles to stand up for. Certainly worth kind of putting your head down and dealing with an ambassador who was sort of persona non grata on the White House grounds for the next couple of months.
Yeah, I agree with that very much. And I think that there's a broader consideration here, which is that it happens not incredibly often, but not infrequently, that a government that's having a scratchy relationship with another government will personalize it to the ambassador, criticize that ambassador in public. And, you know, think about how Vladimir Putin dealt with Michael McFaul when he was the U.S. ambassador in Moscow, for example. And what's important is for the government that sent that ambassador, number one, to understand the scratchiness as a scratchiness in the relationship, not themselves to personalize it to the ambassador. Very occasionally, ambassadors personally become a problem. But in this case, what happened to Sir Kim was, you know, that he was manifesting extant tensions in the US-UK relationship. He wasn't the cause of those tensions. He wasn't exacerbating those tensions. And so taking him out, replacing with somebody else, doesn't actually change anything. Those tensions are still there. The next ambassador is going to do their job and write cables back saying that the Trump White House is chaotic and internally divided and inept, because guess what? They are. And so, you know, I think the danger here is that it contributes to a pattern in which governments can wield personal complaints about ambassadors as a tool in bilateral relationships. And that's one of the things that they're really not supposed to do. We had an issue in the State Department early in the Trump administration when a partner country in the Middle East complained about a career ambassador who, like Sir Kim, was coming to the end of her term anyway. And the Trump administration, instead of standing firm and saying, this is our ambassador, and if you have a problem with what she's saying, then you got to talk to us because she's saying what we tell her to say. They didn't do that. They yanked her early. And it doesn't actually solve problems in relationships. It just confuses the matter.
And it also sort of it seems to suggest that diplomacy is not ambassadors who represent the interests of their own country in a foreign nation, but instead that the job of diplomacy is somehow to cuddle up to or to suck up to whatever party or individual happens to be in power in a given country, which is just not an accurate understanding of sort of the role of diplomacy generally.
Well, and guess whose understanding of diplomacy that is, right? Yeah. Donald Trump's.
Tammy, in talking to people the past couple of days, I've heard people say, you know, the working relationship is fine on the level of, you know, law enforcement, intelligence, security, trade, economy, all that. That's fine. It's kind of going ahead. But clearly there is this, you know, extraordinary strain certainly at the top of the system in terms of, you know, Trump not liking May, now this feud with the ambassador. Trump is accused the British of spying on his campaign, which precipitated a couple of years ago an extraordinary public statement from GCHQ, their signals intelligence agency. And I wonder if this is another example of a special relationship that is actually in a spiral here. I mean, are we overreading that? I mean, should we be worried that something fundamental is going to break down in the US-UK relationship?
Well, I think the broader challenge is what's left that's special in the US-UK relationship. Our colleague at Brookings, Tom Wright, had a piece in The Atlantic this morning reflecting on this business with Ambassador Darroch and noted that Theresa May herself, you know, has behaved not unlike Boris Johnson behaved in that debate. She has yielded to Trump again and again. She's cosseted him. She's turned the other cheek in the face of broadsides, offenses, underminings, outreach to her political opponents, right? And so all of that has already degraded what used to be a relationship of trust that surpassed politics. And that is of a piece with what we've seen in other relationships. You know, I think about the US-Israeli relationship where the leader in Israel is a political ally of Trump, right? And so the Israeli prime minister can do things that have the effect of helping Trump domestically or hurting Trump's domestic opponents in the United States. And Trump does a favor for him on the other side. That kind of meddling in the internal politics of one another is something that undermines the durability of even the most strategic partnerships over time.
Ben, you had a thought.
Yeah, so I do think it is worth, when the president tweets bile about the British ambassador, it is worth pausing over the depth of the relationship that he's playing with. You know, it's been a while since I've looked this up, so I may have the details wrong. But Shane, I'm sure you remember this too, when General Hayden in his book describes on 9/11 or within a couple days of 9/11.
No, it was 2005.
It was 2005?
Yeah.
Right. Calls the head of GCHQ, not the FBI director or the CIA director, and says, if anything happens to this building, by which he means Fort Meade, you're in charge of U.S. signals intelligence. Right? That's the relationship that the president is playing with.
To which GCHQ responded, seriously?
Mike, is there something you want to tell me? That's basically what he said.
am I misremembering?
No, you're not at all. I mean, that is how closely intertwined these two services and countries are, to the point that
I know that I didn't ask Susan this because I didn't want to put her in the position of having to answer the question.
No, you're right. It was fear about a nuclear device, which Hayden doesn't say in his book, but that's my reporting shows that they Al-Qaeda was trying to smuggle some kind of nuclear device in, and they were worried that if Washington were targeted or possibly and the blast radius hit the fort, it was literally like, we're going to transfer all of U.S. signals intelligence to you. And they told Chris Inglis, who was their man in London, like, basically, if we're not here anymore, you're picking it up and go. And so they could literally do this because, I mean, they have so much of each other's sort of – well, Susan's just
one
sort of –
One might hope that the continuity of operations planning has developed a bit in the intervening decade.
But I want to say that is the level of intelligence cooperation between these two countries. And when the president, you know, gets on Twitter and disparages the UK's representatives in the United States, that's what he's putting at risk.
Yeah, that's true. And this is the last button on this. I think that, you know, if you – the systems work together, they share a lot. But I think any – person being honest in British intelligence will tell you that they are the larger beneficiary of that relationship. And so when he does things like this, it also scares them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just we'd like to be friends. It's they know that they depend on us for a lot of things.
That's a really good point.
Okay, let's move on to Elliot Broidy. Remember him? That's a good question. Do you remember him?
Well, I remember him.
You remember Elliot Broidy, that's for sure.
Listeners, do you remember Elliot Broidy?
Elliot Broidy, who is a – Tammy, I'm going to let you describe him, but let me just first sort of lead in why we're talking about him. We're just reading from the New York Times here, Ken Vogel's piece this week, that federal prosecutors have intensified their wide-ranging investigation into Elliot Broidy, a top fundraiser for Trump, signaling the Justice Department's continued interest in questions about foreign influence on the administration. And they go on to say that when you take all of these things that are happening together, they suggest mounting pressure on Broidy and underscore the legal questions raised by his efforts to parlay his access into business advantage in the frenetic weeks after Mr. Trump's election and then to influence the new administration's policies towards the Middle East, where he was pursuing contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So, Tammy, remind us again who Elliot Broidy is and then talk to us about this Middle East connection.
Okay. So, interestingly, it goes – well beyond the Middle East at this point.
Yeah.
So Elliot Broidy was a bundler. And
not a bungler, but a bundler.
Well, maybe
not
a bundler.
Not mutually exclusive. Right. A bungling bungler.
Bungler. Yes. But say certainly a bundler of money for President Trump's campaign and for the RNC. And back in 2015, he bought this company that did defense intelligence and security work on contract for other governments. And so when Trump won the presidency, Broidy basically used his ability to invite people to inaugural events to set up essentially a pay-to-play scheme for his own business, this defense business called Circinus. And so he invited officials from Angola. He invited officials from, I think, Romania and a bunch of other places where he was trying to get contracts for his company. And if these guys came for the inauguration, he then introduced them to Donald Trump. And so, you know, the question here is, this is something that obviously was part of the investigations by the special counsel. But it's not clear, at least from the latest article, what is the goal of the continued Justice Department investigation into Elliot Broidy? What cooperation do they hope to get out of him and related to what matters? So those of you who have been following the Mueller investigation more closely than I have, can you enlighten me?
I don't know that it's related to the Mueller investigation. I think it's related to an undercurrent, which is – it's the corruption, stupid, that the story of all of this, that we're so focused on Russian collusion and was there sort of an agreement and the obstruction questions, which are all important questions, to some extent they've masked the real concern, the reason why we have things like counterintelligence investigations in the first place. And that's whether or not people are using improper channels to influence the United States government, whether or not individuals in the United States government are using their official positions and misusing their official positions in some manner other than the representation of the public interest. And so Broidy is just another in a long sort of string of examples we've seen. We saw Michael Cohen, who doesn't get brought into the administration and immediately starts having these lobbying contracts, you know, with various people. We see Corey Lewandowski do it. To some extent, we even see it in the Mar-a-Lago thumb drive lady, right? Anybody who has access to the president turns around and tries to monetize that
They have
access.
A special relationship.
They have an extremely special relationship.
Well, and some people would say that the president himself tries to monetize the office.
Right. Exactly. And ordinarily, it's not uncommon for people for sort of hangers-on to attempt to monetize the relationships. We expect presidents, though, and administrations to adhere to ethical standards and put up barriers such that they can say in sort of good conscience and respond to this stuff by saying, no, these people are not influencing our administration. And what we've seen is the combination of the quality and number of kind of hangers-on in the Trump orbit that all rush to sort of capitalize on his surprising win, because there's a smaller group than ordinary would be the case when a Republican nominee wins, because his victory was a surprise to most people, and because the Trump administration has been really pretty open about sort of their willingness to engage in this kind of corruption. And I mean, look, you know, the allegations, you know, even just in this New York Times story, right, that Broidy gives inauguration tickets to these Angolan officials, they pay him $6 million. of a $64 million security service contract to his newly formed defense firm. But then they never collect any other money, and he doesn't appear to perform any other services. Gosh, that sounds a lot like somebody selling tickets to inauguration and access to the newly elected president of the United States for $6 million, right? And so, you know, the facts here are they're allegations for now, and we don't quite know what angles the government is looking at this through. But it sure looks like the most sort of basic, brazen forms of corruption and precisely what we need and expect the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to investigate and prosecute when appropriate in order to defend really, really core national security interests of the United States.
And I think, Susan, you're right. I mean, thinking about that, not, you know, that we didn't necessarily, I don't think anybody said we wasted time on L'Affaire Russe, but maybe as it turns out, is that that wasn't actually the story that's going to be the most politically or legally damaging for the president, that there's going to be perhaps some more just underlying, more basic corruption. And by the way, Broidy is connected to two people, both Rick Gates and George Nader, who were tied up in that saga and gave evidence to the government. It's entirely possible that in addition to talking about anything related to Russia, they also handed over what they knew about.
He's also related to the National Enquirer, you know, paying people off to hide obtaining abortion for mistresses.
So that's right.
It's all really getting tied up in a nice bow at the end here.
Yeah, I mean, L'Affaire Russe is important, but I just wonder if it's, you know, if this kind of corruption becomes, to your point, where the garden variety stuff becomes the thing that really the president should be more worried about.
Yeah, so I actually don't think that. So lots and lots of presidents have had lots and lots of people who raise money for them who had little side hustles of their own for which they got in trouble and sometimes got indicted.
Does this qualify $200 million side hustle?
I mean,
what is $64 million among
friends? Some of us are old enough to remember the Chinese money scandal during the Clinton administration, which, you know, involved some relatively in 1998 dollars large sums of money.
It looks so quaint.
It looks quite quaint right now. But like having people surrounding, you know, on the periphery of your campaign and inaugural committee who are lining their pockets is, first of all, disgusting. And you know, it should be investigated, and if there's charges to bring, it should be prosecuted, and no one should say a word of defense of it. And it is not the same order of question as whether there was participation on the part of Trump himself or his immediate campaign of Russian efforts to interfere with the presidential campaign in order to benefit him. And similarly, don't get your hopes up. It will not bring down Donald Trump if some fundraisers around him and some businesses around him were corrupt. I think
he was going to drain the swamp, though.
No one's saying this is a character reference.
Okay. I'm just underscoring the hypocrisy.
Democrats should be running ads with Elia Broidy's face.
Yes, totally.
I'm sure they will run ads with Jeffrey Epstein's pictures with Donald Trump as well. And all of that is fair and all of that. And I'm merely responding to the suggestion that actually while we were looking over here at L'Affaire Russe, there was actually this much bigger scandal, which was, you know, garden variety political corruption. And I don't think that's correct. I think garden variety political corruption is something that is clearly a feature of this administration. It's clearly an ugly and dangerous feature of this administration. But I think what is truly exceptional about this administration is engagement with foreign actors that don't have the U.S. national interests at heart and are willing and a sort of willingness to engage with those actors on a very self-interested, not national interested basis.
Well, in an unbounded basis. I guess the one direct connection I would draw, though, is that it is partly through the vehicle of the Mueller investigation that some of these other corruption cases have been discovered. And likewise, it is through the vehicle of these other corruption investigations that the Justice Department has been able to get some people to provide information relevant to the Russia investigation. So even if they're not all part of the same picture, they are interrelated enough that it facilitates the Justice Department's investigation of a whole array of crimes.
And I will say, even whenever we get sort of, you know, statements from Bill Barr and others that, that really make one wonder about the long-term institutional integrity of the Department of Justice, I do think it's worth noting that this demonstrates how hard it is for a president of the United States to get control of the Department of Justice, and that there are people who really are committed to rule of law principles, who are not afraid to investigate people who might be connected to the president, not to say that they're targeting him. But I do think that we should take heart and be vigilant and pay attention to these investigations, because that attention from the media and others is one element that helps protect and preserve them. But as a little bit of a counterweight to, you know, Barr's investigate the investigators and all the bad signs, stories like these are still, you know, indications that a healthy and independent DOJ does still exist out there.
Can I just note that that makes me feel better about the one personal sadness I had in reading this New York Times story about Elliot Brady, which is that one of the investigations that has arisen out of this is an investigation of a Malaysian businessman who was trying to launder money into the United States to lobby for an end to a Justice Department investigation of his own crimes. And one of the people caught up in that was a member of the Fugees.
Oh, yeah. Praz.
Yeah.
Praz so and Jolo.
That bummed
one
me out,
MDB.
But for the sake of an independent Justice Department, I will take heart.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry. That chapter may yet be written. I think it's going to be good. Speaking of sort of things that were tangential to LaFaire Russe but then blossomed into
like
other
– like the Fugees.
Very ugly things. Yeah. Maybe a little more closely related in this case.
Things related to current pop culture trends.
Yeah.
Like the Fugees.
I'm going to read here from a fantastic news scoop in Yahoo News by the great Mike Isikoff. In the summer of 2016, Russian intelligence agents secretly planted a fake report claiming that the Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich was gunned down by a squad of assassins working for Hillary Clinton, giving rise to a notorious conspiracy theory that captivated conservative activists and was later promoted from inside President Trump's White House. Listeners of the podcast will probably remember, just a quick recap though, Seth Rich was the young DNC staffer who was shot around 4 o'clock in the morning after coming back to his house in Bloomingdale, coincidentally 4 blocks from my house. and almost immediately these conspiracy theories started that he was gunned down by, you know, goons working for Hillary Clinton, because he was probably the source of the DNC and Clinton campaign emails to WikiLeaks. Ben, I think that this story was actually, I mean, one of the more shameful episodes of the whole Russia affair. There was never an ounce of truth to any of it, and it was seized on maliciously by a bunch of just media gadflies and hate mongers, frankly, many of them associated with the White House and with the president. And no one really took it – I think no one with any real sense took it seriously. But explain to us again why this story nevertheless became significant and the importance of now being able to pin this on Russian intelligence agents as the sort of genesis of the conspiracy theory.
So the importance of the story, I think, is threefold. First, that it provided the principal alternative explanation for the DNC hack, other than that the Russians had done it, and that if you were a Trump supporter, or if you were Sean Hannity, or if you were Donald Trump himself,
or Roger Stone,
right, and you wanted some explanation of what happened to the DNC, or Julian Assange, who also peddled in this stuff, and you wanted some explanation for this hacking that did not involve the Russians stealing Hillary Clinton's emails or Democratic emails to benefit Donald Trump, then this provided this death of a DNC staffer. You asserted falsely that this person had in fact been the source of the leak, and
it was an inside job,
and,
just right. like 9/11,
and that right. exonerates the Russians and thereby exonerates the Trump campaign from any possible collusion suggestion. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, simultaneously, it functioned as a change of subject, right? So if you allowed at the same time as you were providing an alternative explanation, you're also saying subtly, if not not subtly. You know, you think Trump, you're accusing Trump of benefiting from from a foreign government hack. Yeah, well, Hillary hired an assassination squad to kill a young staffer at the DNC. I mean, it's a kind of one-upsmanship that was, I think, closely related to she's running a child sex ring out of a pizza shop and,
I would say even more than closely. It stems from the same idea that these are somehow a family of super criminals.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was part of that. The third element of it was, let's be just gross about it for a minute. People love a good murder story, right? And, you know, a DNC staffer gets killed in Washington, D.C., and if you can make a political thriller out of it that somehow involves Hillary, you know, that's going to be a good story that's going to grab a lot of people. And I think all of those were involved, and all of those themes are reflected in the sort of feverish mind of Sean Hannity. And it was clearly a disinformation campaign from early on. It was not clear to me at all that it was a Russian disinformation campaign. And I think, you know, as is often the case, Mike Isikoff just deserves an enormous amount of credit for an astonishing piece of reporting. And I have to say, as somebody who followed this episode pretty closely, it took me by surprise.
Susan, I just want to, like, real quick, just give people some of the details, then and come to you and ask you about them and other comments you want to make. But what Mike found was that the SVR, which is Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, circulated what he calls a phony bulletin disguised to read as a real intelligence report about the murder. And it was just 3 days later that it starts, I guess, these conspiracy theories start popping up and affecting the internet and or sort of the news cycles. Now, not mainstream news necessarily, but they start showing up on these conspiracy theory websites. And he goes on to say how the Russian effort to exploit Rich's tragic death didn't stop with just the fake bulletin. Over the next 2.5 years, the Russian government-owned media organizations RT and Sputnik repeatedly played up stories that baselessly alleged that Rich, a relatively junior-level staffer, was the source of Democratic Party emails leaked to WikiLeaks. So, I mean, to me, it was this kind of deeply unsettling example of how this fake bulletin, which by the reporting, it sounds like nobody should have been fooled into thinking this was a real thing, nevertheless does become like this point of infection. And then suddenly it just spreads. And, you know, I think plenty of people weren't taking it seriously, but it got such massive airtime and it was picked up in foreign press as well. It was always just sort of hanging out there, kind of polluting the whole story. And it just makes me think, you know, I mean, boy, did the Russians have our number.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's yet another example of the direct line from the Kremlin and Russian intelligence into the Trump campaign, right? And that and we can trace, there are countless examples in which you can trace, you know, in the Mueller report and now stories like this, Russian propaganda coming, you know, being used through sort of propaganda outlets like RT, Sputnik, and others. And then it's picked up by the Trump campaign and their associates, and eventually we see it on Don Jr.'s Twitter feed or the president's Twitter feed or in an official White House statement. And so what's really disturbing here is the closeness of that leap, right? This is not things that are circulating in some crazy corners of the internet and then slowly after months and years somehow make their way into, you know, sort of more mainstream conservative media. This is, you know, leaps that occur almost immediately, so immediately that you have to wonder or assume if Trump allies and close associates aren't actively looking in those spaces, right? And so whenever we talk about the way Mueller talked about things like coordination, the ordinary definition of coordination would be that you see what the other person is doing and you take responsive action. You know, that's one definition of coordination. Mueller says, no. Coordination requires this explicit agreement. And I think it's another example of, you know, whenever you have the internet and you're talking about laundering pieces of propaganda, that explicit agreement, it really isn't necessary to be incredibly effective. You know, some of the details of this story that are new and I guess they shouldn't be shocking, but are, you know, is that Steve Bannon is somebody who, you know, he's texting a 60 Minutes producer, a huge story. He was a Bernie guy. It was a contract kill, obviously, in March 2017, right? And so you actually have White House officials who are stoking this story, and you know, sort of just this appalling story, and that all these people are acting in bad faith, right? These are not people who are duped and they think, oh, well, maybe this is what happened. You know, Julian Assange knows that he did not get this information from Seth Rich. He knew that he was lying when he suggested that, you know, oh, he was offering a $20,000 reward because our sources take risks. They were lying. They were taking this piece of propaganda and they were using it in a really exploitative way. And, you know, one thing that does, you know, Isakoff is a really beautiful writer. And one thing that that is sort of a subtle undercurrent of this story is how painful this was to the Rich family, that it continues to be incredibly painful. And that this was a great kid who was 27 and, like so many sort of people that we know in Washington, D.C., really did appear to be an idealist who wasn't a Bernie or a Hillary person, but just somebody who was really committed to the idea of voting rights. And appeared to be a good friend and a good son and came to the city to be a good citizen. And so the idea that his sort of tragic murder would be used in this way to cause so much additional pain on his family, you know, that's a part of this, that whenever you see, you know, the participation and the knowing participation of people like Fox and Friends, I mean, big media outlets that have no excuse for doing this stuff, you know, it really is stomach turning. I don't know how else to describe it.
I think it's stomach turning. I think another thing that really struck me in the story, and I agree with you in commending Isakoff in getting to this and making and writing it in there, is the way in which this conspiracy theory, this BS cover story, interfered with the actual criminal investigation into who was responsible for the murder of this young man. And so not only does his family have to go through the pain of seeing these bizarre and baseless allegations made about their dead child, but they also know that the DC cops and prosecutors who are trying to figure out who actually did this are having to field all kinds of crazy leads that are rooted in this wacky conspiracy theory, to the point that they can't do a proper investigation of the solid information that might be available. And so this family may never get closure. They may never find out what actually happened and who actually killed their child. And I think that also really came through strongly. I have to note, too, that, yes, the national media and Fox News channel in particular has a lot of culpability here. And the Rich family has sued, I think, appropriately on that basis. But, you know, the local Fox affiliate actually was the first Fox outlet to push this story. And I think that it also goes, you know, and linking this to the Brody segment that we just did, it goes to highlight the extent to which not Trump, the people who work for Trump, the people around Trump, are willing to go to any lengths without even thinking twice on behalf of their own political or financial advantage, but they're willing to go to lengths that they know are contrary to the national interests and national security of the United States. In other words, it's not just that they're willing to spread a rumor. They're willing to spread a rumor that they know is wrong, that they have reason to believe is the result of a foreign influence operation.
I mean, there is one big question that this story leaves, which is why this wasn't included in the Mueller report. So one of the reasons that Isakoff is able to break this story is because the former assistant U.S. attorney who was in charge of the case and has since retired went on record. And she says that she used her own security clearance to access copies of the SVR intelligence reports that had been intercepted by U.S. officials. She later wrote a memo documenting the Russian role in fomenting the conspiracy theories that she sent to DOJ's National Security Division and, quote, personally briefed special counsel Robert Mueller's prosecutors on her findings. Mm. And so it is a little bit of a puzzle as to, you know, that we've all focused on what actually ended up in the Mueller report. This is a little bit of a reminder that there's a lot out there that's on the cutting room floor. And you have to ask yourself, why didn't this make the cut? And what else is out there you know, that they ultimately decided not to include? And based on this story, it's not clear to me why this wouldn't have been included.
All right. Let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first since we're on the subject of this great Isikoff piece. There is a companion podcast series that Mike and his colleagues at Yahoo have done called Conspiracy Land. I believe it's going to be 6 parts. I listened to the first part yesterday and today, and it's excellent. It's really well produced. It is kind of – he narrates it and you hear him doing interviews with some of the key participants. And in the first couple of episodes, he'll kind of lay out a lot of what's in this scoopy piece. One of my neighbors shows up in it, which is kind of fun.
DC is such a
the guy who
town.
Runs the neighborhood listserv. yeah, it's really terrific. And again, just props to Mike for doing this. And I think he also very thoughtfully lays out in the first couple of minutes of the podcast why he's doing it, so that you don't think it's not something that's exploitative or ghoulish in any way. It's extremely thoughtful. And he did actually interview family members of Seth Rich, which is very hard to hear, but it is an extremely good taste, and it's very fair and a reminder of why he's such a good reporter, because he gets people to talk to him and he treats them fairly and respectfully.
And by the way, if you ever want a truly model book about reporting on presidential scandal, Mike Isikoff's book, Uncovering Clinton,
so good.
Is an almost miraculously good book about reporting on Paula Jones and getting to know Linda Tripp and the Monica Lewinsky affair.
I feel like we should say something insulting about Mike just to like clean
it up. But he's a pain in the ass.
He's a real pain in the ass. And
he's a terrible cook. And
don't listen to his podcast with Danny Clyde and Spellbugger.
Oh, let's see. Ben,
listen to Rational Security.
Rational Security instead. Ben, what's your object?
I was scanning while we were chatting for the passage in Mike Hayden's book that we were talking about, and I came upon it, and so it is my object lesson. It reads as follows. We had one final option to exercise for continuity of operations. This is NSA's continuity of operations. As we approached one holiday season with a particularly high quotient of background terrorist chatter, I called David Pepper of GCHQ to tell him that in the event of a catastrophic loss at Fort Meade, we would entrust the management of the U.S. SIGINT system to him and to our senior representative in London. The long pause on the other end of the secure line betrayed both the gravity of the threat and the enormous burden I was imposing on a friend. So I just think, read the president's tweets about Sir Kim in light of that one little anecdote.
What he doesn't tell you is David Pepper responded, "What you talking about, Willis?"
Well, you've just been waiting for a chance to do
that. It would have been the perfect moment for him to do it, too. Just like, pin drop. Say what now? Susan, what's your object?
So my object lesson is a Politico story that's actually an excerpt of a forthcoming book. The title is, quote, "Mother is not going to like this. The 48 hours that almost brought down Donald Trump." And it's by Tim Alberta, who his forthcoming book, American Carnage, sort of is about
another great reporter.
The conservative movement's initial disgust and ultimate embrace of Donald Trump, and this Politico article sort of maps the 48 hours around the publication of the Access Hollywood tapes, and is a piece that really captures in real time the compromises that people made, including sort of the reaction of the Pences, right? So it's actually Donald Trump who hangs up the phone with Pence and says, "Oh boy, mother is not going to like this." Of course, Mike Pence famously calls his wife mother. So putting that aside, and it's you know, him, the story of Pence and Karen Pence praying after this tape comes out, and her very strong stance. And
what were they praying for exactly?
I don't know. Deliverance.
Not the victims.
You know, within 48 hours, Pence is back on the campaign trail. So however the Lord answered, apparently he was cool with the Access Hollywood tape. But it does show sort of just the real-time compromises, how craven the individuals around the Trumps are, you know, including the vice president and including people who hold themselves out to be moral paragons. And so it's a totally fascinating story. I'm really looking forward to reading the full book. And if my husband ever calls me mother, I... I don't know, man.
Susan, a boy's best friend is his mother. Listeners will know where that comes from. Well, that's the end of the podcast, you guys. I have nothing to say about my mother, so we might as well just like wrap up the show. She's probably not listening anyway.
Do you call Joe mother?
You know, he is listening and probably just fell out of his chair right about now.
Sorry, Joe.
I have a joke locked and loaded, but I'm gonna let it
pass.
Is it
locked and loaded or cocked and loaded?
Cocked and loaded.
Stop.
Oh my God. Rational Security is a production of Lawfare. You can find our show page at lawfareblog.com. You can find our Mike Pence Rational Security mother dolls at
thelawfarestore.com, where you can also spend give us $6 million for tickets to the next inauguration.
We will also sell inauguration tickets.
And I totally won't get you access to the president for it, so don't worry.
He won't even get you access to the inauguration.
I mean, come on. What's $6 million? They're not even good seats, just to let you know. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook whenever you download the podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, Luminary, a new service you might want to check out. Please be sure to leave us a rating and review. It really helps us out. Our audio engineer this week was Michaela Fogel. The show is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Music this week by Kim Derrick with his slowed down, sad version of the British punk classic London Calling.
Aww.
That's Sir Kim to you.
You just see him like a oasis, like with a little guitar. Just kind of
he would have fun with that.
He would have fun with that. Sophia Yam would too. On behalf of my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, Ben Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.